Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Wir bei Vertex wissen, dass die Geschwindigkeit des globalen Handels zunimmt, was eine Steuerverwaltung komplexer macht. Und ihre unternehmenseigenen Systeme sind nicht dafür ausgelegt, diese Steuerkomplexität zu bewältigen. Hier setzen wir mit unserer Plattform an, die Continuous Compliance ermöglicht. So erhalten Sie mehr Transparenz, mehr Genauigkeit und mehr Vertrauen in Ihre Steuerdaten. Sie wollen mehr über Continuous Compliance erfahren? Dann besuchen Sie vertexinc.com/de.
It used to be seen as a costly and risky challenge, but sustainability has now become a business imperative.
Not having the data is no longer an excuse.
I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. Our second episode is all about moving from intention to action on sustainability. Episode 2 of Resilient Edge is coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing, and on this edition, a lifeline for the Maldives. India signs a currency swap deal worth $400 million to help the island nation overcome mounting economic problems. Also, how employment in the tech sector in the US could affect the outcome of the election there next month. We'll take a look at what's behind the drop in German economic output and Vietnam's remarkable growth rate, despite last month's devastating typhoon. But is it sustainable? And I've got some exciting news. From now on, you can contact us on WhatsApp or send us a voice note, +44 330 678 3033. I'll repeat that, +44 330 678 3033. And of course, the old way still works too. You can email us at any time on world.business@bbc.co.uk. Now, the Maldives is a chain of 1,192 tiny coral islands stretching around 800 kilometres in the Indian Ocean. It's also a country with big financial problems. It's staring at a debt default as its foreign exchange reserves have dropped to $440 million. That's just enough for 1.5 months of imports. So the visit of its president, Mohamed Muizu, to India in search of a bailout is of huge significance, and not least from the fact that when he campaigned for election a year ago, it was on an India out policy, demanding that Delhi must withdraw its troops from his country. Well, despite that, on Monday, he signed a currency swap deal with India worth $400 million and was full of praise for his host.
India is a key partner in the socio-economic and infrastructure development of the Maldives and has stood by the Maldives during our times of need. We look forward to concluding the free trade agreement with India, which will enable us to harness the full economic potential between our countries and to increase Indian investments in both our tourism and various sectors of development.
President Muizu speaking a little while back in India. Well, I'm joined by our South Asia regional editor, Etarajan Anbarasan. Thanks for being with us, Anbarasan. I mean, first of all, how did we get here? Why is the Maldives in such financial trouble?
Well, Maldives is a country of only 500,000 population, out of which 100,000 are expatriate workers, and the country mainly depends on tourism revenue. It earns hundreds of millions of dollars, especially in high-end tourism, with people coming from Europe and the US and from across the world for its turquoise beaches and for snorkeling. Now, what happened during the COVID? Nearly for 2 years, the tourism industry was devastated, so the country's air revenue plummeted, putting the revenue in a big, big danger. That's why they had to approach India for economic assistance. And they also borrowed a lot of money, hundreds of millions of dollars, to improve their infrastructure. For example, connecting the capital, Malé, with the airport, which is on another island, an artificially reclaimed island called Hulu Malé. As the population is expanding, they're also needing more space. So this also, you know, new airstrips, and also jetties in different islands, because it's all important for the tourism. And building housing for the residents of the Maldives. So then they had started repaying this debt, and that is where the problem came, because when your revenue is dropping and then your debt service is starting, then there is a huge problem. That's what we saw in Sri Lanka a couple of years ago, how the country declared bankruptcy in the immediate aftermath of COVID pandemic. So that is why the Maldivian government was really in red. It had enough money only to buy a month and a half imports. In fact, the usable reserves was less than $440 million. So India, as you said, offered a lifeline to the Maldives by giving this $400 million in currency swap, and also another $350 million as part of like an Indian rupee, where they can buy Indian goods using that Indian currency.
Now, it's very interesting, isn't it, that it's got itself into this position, as you said, in a similar way to what happened in Sri Lanka, and with tourism obviously as the underlying factor in the economy of the Maldives. In fact, let's just hear from a travel agent owner, sounding actually a little bit more positive, who's operating in the Maldives.
My name is Abdullah Ghias. Our main business is bringing in tourists into the Maldives from different parts of the world. We had a record-breaking year for the Maldives. In fact, February was the highest number of tourists we have ever had in our history in the last 52 years. Our members were one of the first to actually come to the Indian market in the last 20 years. So we had a Welcome India roadshow. So what happened today is instrumental going forward, because India still remains a very, very important source market for Maldives.
And that was a travel agent owner operating in the Maldives speaking to us earlier. Well, let's also hear from someone who's been analysing some of the problems very much that Yuan Barasan laid out there. Aditya Gurdwara Shivamurthy is an associate at the Observer Research Foundation in India. I spoke to him and he told me why a positive relationship now is so crucial for India and the Maldives.
This point in time, Maldivian economy is under deep economic distress, right? The foreign reserves have consistently dwindled, and the debts have been piling up, especially from the commercial lenders and from the Chinese loans. So I think the current visit towards India and these agreements, especially the currency swap agreement with India that has been, is definitely a good indication of things to come ahead. So it's quite important for Maldives at this point of time to increase its foreign reserves and to boost its economy. And I think the current visit, which will be followed up with the Moise's visit to Mumbai and Bengaluru, is tend to hopefully increase more private investments and more economic interactions with India, which is a good sign to begin with.
How big is the interaction currently between India and the Maldives economically? How dependent is the Maldives on India?
It is a hugely import-dependent economy. In this case, India is one of its top exporter, and it's also one of its top market in terms of importing, although compared to Western markets, it's still lesser. But I think India is one of the biggest economic partner in terms of trade. But when it comes to development cooperation and high impact development projects as well, India is one of the biggest investors in the Maldives. And India has been consistently offering more loans and grants and more infrastructure projects on concessional aid to the Maldives. So that way speaking, India is one of the biggest economic partner and trade partner that the Maldives has.
And the Maldivian economy, you said, is in a really bad way. It depends on tourism very much. But is tourism not delivering then for the Maldivians?
No, I think it's a couple of reasons. The Maldivian government has always run on a subsequent budget deficit. And one, there is always a trade deficit. As I said, the Maldivian economy is consistently dependent on imports. But at the same time, the government in itself, since it became a democracy since 2008, subsequent presidents, subsequent governments have all, you know, tried to be populist in a way, you know, bringing down tax, offering more subsidies, bringing in mega infrastructure projects and making education free, offering more and more health schemes. So basically in a way that could muster more support for them. So that problem has always been there. But what happened following the COVID-19 was one, that the tourism was subsequently disrupted and the tourist revenues fell down, and following which a lot of capital borrowings came in. Previous government of the Maldives under Abdullah Yamin had subsequently borrowed a lot from China. So all of these loans are being repaid in recent years. And then there is food and fuel inflation with the Russia-Ukraine war, obviously. So all of these factors are consistently impacting the Maldivian economy.
And Aditya, you mentioned obviously that in the past, quite a close relationship in some ways economically with China. This is a president of the Maldives who campaigned on getting India out of the Maldives. Now he's in Delhi going for a free trade agreement. Is this a huge turnaround away from China and towards India?
So I wouldn't call it a zero-sum game for the very reason, look, when Muizu came into power with all of this India Out campaign, there were two things that were very critical for him. One, win the presidential elections, and two, win the parliamentary elections. And both of them have worked sufficiently well with his anti-India rhetoric. He has done whatever he wanted to do. And at the same time, he had a close relationship with China historically, and that is what he tried to maintain even when he became a president. But that has obviously not been successful enough. Now, for the very first 3-4 months that we saw him in power, we saw him calling India a bully. We saw him defending his ministers who were hurling racist remarks against India and Indian Prime Minister. But then I think there was a significant expectation that if he continues to go on this anti-India rhetoric, China will continue to support him and China will offer more and more aid. But that has not been the case. In fact, China has not been able to offer more assistance. And the promises that Muizu was seeing that China would offer has not obviously come to fructification. And that is why he's seeing India as a subsequent alternative. So I think there is some kind of recalibration in his approach towards India, hoping to get more and more economic assistance from India.
Aditya Gaudara Shivamurthy there of the Observer Research Foundation in India. Still with me, our South Asia regional editor, Etirajan Anbarasan. Anbarasan, I mean, it's interesting what was mentioned there about a free trade agreement, potentially. Is there more that the Maldivian president will be trying to sort out while he's in India?
Well, one thing is about getting this money so that he can increase the foreign exchange reserves. And second thing is also about increasing the number of tourists. Even though Maldives is known for very high-end tourism, the Indian tourists go for mid and lower level. That is where, you know, a lot of Maldivians, they are operating these hotels and resorts for medium-level tourism. And in addition to that, he's looking for a long term. Now, in case if he wants to go for any IMF bailout, India's support is crucial because US is also aligned with India and they all have a security maritime cooperation. So that is why now he has come to the reality that because he didn't get the enough money from China and also from Gulf countries, now he has reached out to India. What we are seeing now is more about Asian power rivalry between India and China. Now, China has already given about $1.4 billion loan to the Maldives, and India has given a similar amount. And both these countries are trying to dominate the Indian Ocean region, where more than 70% of the global trade happens. And that is what you see, both countries trying to get a foothold in the Maldives. And now It looks like, at the time being, Mr. Muiz has reached out to India for economic help.
A very interesting moment. Thank you so much for being with us, South Asia regional editor there, Etirajan Anbarasan, talking to me about the visit of the president of the Maldives to India. Now, let's talk to our markets guest today, Rachel Winter, partner and investment manager at Killick & Co. Rachel, thank you for being with us once again on World Business Report. I suppose the really interesting thing that's moving the markets right now is oil. I mean, not unsurprising, I suppose, given all the tensions there are in the Middle East. So what's been happening in terms of the oil price?
Well, oil has moved. So whenever there's tension in the Middle East, you would expect concerns about the supply of oil to cause a spike in the price. So over the last 4 weeks, we have seen oil rising by about 11%. But actually, if we look over the last 12 months, oil is actually down over that time period. So there are a couple of things putting downward pressure on the oil price. One of those is a reduction in the demand from China, which is a big user of oil. And the other is an expected increase in production from Saudi Arabia, which will produce more supply and therefore bring down the price. So although it's definitely true that oil has come up, it's perhaps a bit surprising that it hasn't come up more.
Let's talk also then about some figures that came out at the end of last week from the US, employment figures that were really quite surprisingly positive in terms of the number of people employed and the few number of people unemployed in the US right now. Obviously very important in an electoral cycle, but also quite important for markets trying to sort of guess what the Fed's going to do. What's been the reaction?
Yeah, so great numbers here. The US economy added 254,000 jobs in September, so well ahead of expectations. And also the unemployment rate came down from 4.3% to 4.1%. So all very good, but it does mean the Federal Reserve is probably less likely to cut interest rates again at the next meeting. So potentially over the short term, that could actually be a bit of a negative for investors.
And a boost for shares? How has Wall Street responded?
Yes, very good, actually. So when we had the jobs data on Friday, the market did react very well to that. So we did see a rise in the market then.
Good. Thanks very much indeed for being with us, and stay with us, in fact, Rachel. I'm going to talk to you a little bit later in the programme as well. But let's turn our minds then from the US employment figures to a more specific area of the US economy. The election is less than a month away in the US. The economy is still the top issue on most voters' minds, and there have been tough times for employment hitherto, up to those figures we heard about on Friday. And especially the problem has been in the tech sector. Intel, Amazon, Microsoft, they're just a few of the major companies who announced sizable layoffs this year. Well, World Business Report's Monica Miller has been having a look at what's been happening.
September's unemployment data beat many analysts' expectations. The U.S. added 254,000 jobs in September, and the unemployment rate fell from 4.2% in August to 4.1% last month. But if you're one of the 6.8 million people out of work, like Andre Balish, the numbers bring little comfort.
I've been out of work for about 2 years.
The Brooklyn resident worked in e-commerce for roughly 20 years, doing product and program management. He's currently looking for an opportunity based on his experience.
And it's been a struggle all across the board. I think there's a lot of great candidates right now that are looking, and companies have been reluctant to hire, especially in the last 2 years.
Andre says there are days of frustration, but he's grateful he has a supportive family and has joined a community of job seekers called Never Search Alone.
It's great to have other people that you can talk through the process with and where you are, be able to reflect on things that you've done well, opportunities for you to improve, and, you know, and just, again, get context as far as, you know, what's going on.
People in the tech world are facing a serious economic downturn.
Phil Terry wrote a job search guidebook called Never Search Alone in 2022. That's the same year tens of thousands of tech workers were laid off after the pandemic. Having worked with Silicon Valley companies for roughly 25 years, Phil got the idea of running free support groups from a senior vice president at Peloton who was looking for work. And the idea caught on. Today, his staff of volunteers are currently running 2,300 job search groups around the world.
If you're looking for a job, everyone's anxious and insecure, even in a good job market. In a bad job market, that's tripled, right?
Phil says there has been a dramatic decline in venture capital funding that backs startups and small businesses in the tech sector. But there could be some positive news on the horizon. The U.S. Federal Reserve cut the benchmark federal funds interest rates by a half a percentage point last month, a move which will ease the cost of borrowing.
The tech economy is very sensitive to interest rates, and tech is now so much a part of everything, right? So I hope that that helps.
I sat down with acting U.S. Labor Secretary Julie Hsu, who said they've seen job growth almost across the board in construction, clean energy, hospitality, and healthcare. But she also says it's not a linear process and doesn't happen every single month the same way.
I don't know, how to predict for a particular industry, but I do think that the more we invest to grow the economy overall, the more industries benefit, right? So, you know, when you have a factory that's built in a community like, you know, Racine, Wisconsin, where the president went to announce a Microsoft data center, you know, you create jobs there. That obviously builds up the community, especially when they're good jobs, right? People, families can do better. People move into the community. Now there's, you know, the local economy that's needed for that.
Andre is also hopeful his field will start hiring again and has some tips for other job seekers.
Have a structure, have a routine, have some things outside of the job search because the job search will be frustrating. And so have some things that you can look forward to that are not going to be frustrating. And you know, look for things that help remind you that you have value.
That report by Monica Miller. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, Germany's latest economic data makes grim reading. Manufacturing orders fell 5.8% month on month in August, the sharpest drop in new orders for 7 months. The decline was in part driven by large orders for transport equipment, including aircraft, ships, trains and military vehicles made in the previous month. But it's also part of an economic malaise that's led many to predict Europe's largest economy will be in recession by the end of the year. Thilo Brodmann is the executive director of the German Machinery and Equipment Manufacturers Association. I asked him what he thought was happening.
We see, of course, a decrease in order intake, in capacity used, in all these parameters. But putting it into relation, for example, for the pandemic or for the start of the Ukraine war, this drop is not that deep. So we do not want to over-exaggerate it, but you're right, it's a bit gloomy because we, for example, in the mechanical engineering industry, we are facing a decrease of 8% in production this year, and we are facing another one of 2% decrease next year. So this is not what we are really used as a successful sector industry. You're right, it's a bit gloomy.
Well, yes, and you mentioned obviously the Ukraine war and COVID, but those are not things now that should be providing the shock. So what's going on?
It's a combination of several things that mingle up to something that makes it a bit gloomy. Of course, we all face this necessity for transformation, to decarbonize economy and production, to have more energy efficiency in there. So you have heavy invests on the one hand. On the other hand, you have lacking order intake. So that gives a friction, of course. Next thing you have is a very, very aggressive China on the Chinese market, on third markets around the world, and also in Europe, giving some problems for those who used to deliver the world all the time over the last past 50 years. So it's a couple of things that mingles up to something gloomy. It's not the one thing. Of course, besides this, you have not really working German politic at the moment. And you have, of course, some changes in the European Commission, which makes them stop work for the time being until the new commission is on board. So it's a couple of five or six reasons that lead to this, what we see there.
But the reasons you're suggesting there, I guess, are, again, things that could change. The German government gets its act together, I suppose. The commission settles in, etc. Do you think then perhaps by the end of this year, perhaps the first quarter of 2025, we're going to see a change? We will see an uptick?
Yes, I think so. I would say in the first half of the next year, that is possible. If we try and give it a chance by politics, yes, it's possible, but it will be a slow recovery so that the year 25 is in our expectance some bumpy road, still some bumpy road with maybe a horizontal thing of more or less 0 or 1 or 2% minus.
But the China factor, which you also mentioned, I suppose, is not going to go away. We don't really know what's happening with the Chinese economy, but the problem of the interconnection between Germany and China historically is something that could be a long-term drag, couldn't it?
Yes, of course, this was foreseen for a couple of years. So everybody tries to do that, what we call de-risking. So they're in heavily investments also in India, in the ASEAN countries, and so on. So you get some more balanced way of looking at that, but this takes some time. So until we see the success, will take maybe another 2 to 5 years. So for the next year, still bumpy roads, not the real solution for this situation with the Chinese economy.
So going forward, you've already said perhaps things will improve in 2025. What is it that the government and the European Commission could do that would help your industry the most?
Well, we suffered a lot of bureaucracy with the last commission and, of course, also in German politics because those European regulations come onto the national level soon after. So stopping this and looking as a commission more into the question, how competitive are we on an international level, and to do more things in that direction than giving you reporting duties, that would really help because our member companies in the mechanical engineering sector, they have some 180, 200 people. And they have an 80% export share. So they want to do innovation. They want to be on an international level active, and they do not want to work on reporting duties all the day.
Thilo Brodmann there, talking about the German economy. Now, Rachel Winter's still with me. Do you share his optimism? Things are going to get better?
Well, I think they will get better, but it is disappointing to see Germany missing these very low expectations. And it puts it in a real contrast to the US, which is doing really well at the moment. So I think most investors would prefer to invest over there presently.
All right, Rachel, thanks so much for being with us. Rachel Winter there. Now, Vietnam, in contrast, along with China, North Korea and Cuba, is one of the world's few remaining officially communist states. It's also one of the world's fastest growing economies. Its latest figures are impressive, growth of 7.4% in the third quarter from a year earlier. The Prime Minister, Pham Minh Vinh, ordered ministries to implement what he called drastic measures to boost economic growth to more than 7% this year overall. And all this despite September seeing one of the worst storms in the country's history, Typhoon Yagi. Nha Pham is a freelance Vietnamese journalist based in Taiwan and a regular guest on our business programs here. I asked her how reliable these remarkable growth figures are.
I don't think that Vietnam has recovered at all. I think the statistics actually are based on the situation before Typhoon Yagi. 7.4% is indeed a very, very high growth rate. And I don't think that it's sustainable for Vietnam actually to expect such growth in the last quarter of the year.
So now you say that it's not really sustainable, but something like 7.4% is pretty dramatic. Doesn't that suggest that the economy is booming?
Yes, the economy actually has been doing okay. I mean, 7.4%, as you said, you know, is tremendous. And it is because, you know, the exports and also manufacturing sectors in Vietnam were really developing very fast. However, as we said before, Typhoon Yagi, the damages caused by the typhoon is also very, very large. It's estimated at $3.3 billion. So I really don't know how the economy is going to pick up after that. And the prime minister now has ordered ministries to try their best to achieve above 7% growth rate for the whole year. But I think it's just wishful thinking, really. It's very difficult to maintain.
Which are the sectors that are really pushing this, though? Because clearly agriculture, forestry and fisheries would have been very badly affected by the typhoon. But there's quite a lot of industrial production, particularly in the tech sector, isn't there?
Yes, that's right. But, you know, don't forget that agriculture and exports are the main sectors that contributed to the growth rate. So if the, you know, farmland and, you know, the rivers, the exports are affected, then we can't expect 7% for the whole year. And also you mentioned tech manufacturing. Very bad news for Vietnam just now that I've heard that Google, for example, has picked Malaysia to invest in a data hub. 1 month ago, everyone was talking that Vietnam is the destination and Google is going to invest in Vietnam billions and billions of dollars, but now it's not going to materialize anymore. So news like that make me a bit less optimistic about the whole year, to be honest. So, I mean, we have to wait and see in 3 more months and if Vietnam can really, really try to make it happen.
The other issue, I guess, is the destination of its exports, because the US is, I think, Vietnam's biggest trading partner in export terms, or has been so far. And we know there are pressures in the US in terms of curbing foreign imports. Do you see that as a problem going ahead?
That is a part of the problem, yes. And the economy in the US also experienced some uncertainty. I mean, you know, the presidential elections coming up, so that is one market that Vietnam's got to worry about. And also, we have to remember that Vietnam and China's largest export market is also experiencing some tensions in geopolitics. Is always playing a role in the Vietnam-China economic relations. So I don't know. I mean, I have that feeling that it's not going to get any better. Last week, we heard about some incident in the South China Sea where Vietnamese fishermen were beaten up by the Chinese law enforcement officers. And that is going to make the relationship even more difficult. So all that those factors playing, I think, yeah, again, back to the 7% growth rate is not going to look very optimistic for Vietnam.
Now, Pham there speaking to me about Vietnam. That's it from World Business Report from me and the rest of the team. Bye-bye.
It used to be seen as a costly and risky challenge, but sustainability has now become a business imperative.
Not having the data is no longer an excuse.
I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. Our second episode is all about moving from intention to action on sustainability. Episode 2 of Resilient Edge is coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.